Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
According to tradition, it was two brothers, Harihara and Bukka, that founded Vijayanagara, the city of victory, on the southern banks of the Tungabhadra. Over the century and a half that followed, that Vijayanagara frequently lived up to its name, holding its own against its rivals. But it would reach its power at the early 16th century under the reign of Krishnadevaraya. Krishnadevaraya is frequently thought of as one of India's greatest monarchs. But what sort of man was he? Thankfully for us, there's a new biography out about him. It's simply called Raya. The book is by Srinivas Reddy. And Anirudh and I are absolutely thrilled to have him on this podcast. Welcome, Srinivas.
Hey, Srinivas.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And by the way, Srinivas will be joining Anirudh for another conversation on Friday, the 29th of May. So if you want to join that conversation online, do RSVP the address that we provided in the description. Now, Srinivas Reddy is a scholar, a translator, a musician. He trained in classical South Asian languages and literatures at Brown University and at the University of California, Berkeley. His research interests incorporate translational studies, Vijayanagara history, and classical Indian music theory and practice. Srinivas, I just want to start with really a basic question. What got you interested firstly in Vijayanagara and more specifically in Krishnadevaraya?
Thank you so much, Aditya. Anirudh, it's great to be here with you guys. I'll just speak from the heart. To be quite frank, it was in graduate school, and my dear friend Jennifer Clare was applying for a graduate student conference. And we were really young, just starting out. And she said, why don't you apply for this conference with me and we'll go to Texas. It was at Austin. And I said, I don't know what to do. And she's like, here's this book on Vijayanagara. This is good Telugu stuff. You'll like it. And I loved that book. And I was like, this is amazing. And then I learned that, you know, this great king, Krishnadevaraya, who I'd heard about when I was, you know, growing up, just as like anyone hears about, was also a great poet. And, you know, my field was literature. So it's like, perfect. This is great. You know, this great king also is a great poet. So let me read his poetry. And that's basically how I got into Vijayanagara, was actually through Raya and specifically through Raya's poetry.
Can you just, to lay the framework for our listeners, can you just tell us a little bit about Vijayanagara?
Well, it was founded like in the 14th century and we're talking about the medieval period of India, if in generally what classical historians would call the medieval period, let's say. And these periodizations of history are, you know, of course, subject to much discussion. But I'll talk about that specifically because Raya does represent something I think interesting in a way that we could look at arcs of history. But, you know, basically these guys come up like many other kingdoms. Small kingdoms, generally Kshatriya backgrounds, you know, local chiefs, warlords who made their ways into great empires. Vijayanagara was one of them that flourished. And like you said, reached its apex around 1500 at the time of Raya. And at that point, that's when we kind of get the image of what Vijayanagara is, as like the great empire of the South with merchants from all over the world coming and jewels being sold in basket loads and, you know, great poets and, you know, great kings and luxury and literature, all of that kind of imagery that's it right at 1500. So that's kind of Vijayanagara. Maybe I can just speak for a little bit about what I meant by that. I was thinking about this. You know, the 500 BC is often talks about is this axial age. You know, you had these great thinkers, Buddha, yes. Right? So 1500 to me, 2000 years later, to me is another big axial kind of moment in the sense that, you know, this is a critical period. This is when all of the globalized world is coming together. This is the birth of colonialism is about to happen. You know, Portuguese, Persians, Indians, everyone's mixing around, doing all sorts of interesting things. Technology is changing. But I was thinking about it more importantly, and I don't think people get into this as much, which is critical, is that we have a massive epistemological shift that happens in 1500. Because you see what Raya represents is a pinnacle. He is the zenith of a tradition, you know? Telugu literature started 500 years before. Raya is the peak of that thing. Mm. And then really, pretty much after Raya, there's not much produced in that vein of, you know, classical knowledge. But you know, not at that level. It's on a decline, you could say.
Can you actually elaborate on that a little bit, Srinivas? I think that's a thread I'd actually like to tease out a little. Because Vijayanagara in so many ways has been appropriated, reappropriated by various linguistic nationalist narratives. It's appropriated both by Kannada nationalists as also by Telugu nationalists. And as you said, Krishnadevaraya represents this 500-year-old Telugu literary tradition that arguably reaches its zenith with him. And even though it's continued in the Nayaka period, even though it continues in Carnatic music and all that, what is it really about Krishnadevaraya that makes that moment in history unique for Telugu literature?
Well, you know, Raya was just a representative because like all of these great poets were kind of like peaking at that time. Peddana, Durjati, all these people that we hear about, you know, the great Gajas, the great eight poets, you know, all of that stuff is maybe all of that also, if you want to really get into the details, maybe that's also kind of a myth that's been created over time as well. You know, Narayan Rao and Shulman talk about that crystallization of this, you know, Vijayanagara myth, the narrative of Raya being the apex. That's also a certain narrative that we've created. There was plenty of Telugu literature that happened after that.
Hmm.
Arguably, though, I mean, just on a literary point, in terms of that high Prabandha court style and the kind of literati that is needed to support that, you understand what I'm saying? You need a milieu to have that happening, of rasikas and poets and all that stuff. That really reached a peak at that point. And again, I said courtly literature. So that's related to the politics of the whole thing. So when the politics start breaking down, forms of literature also are going to change, you know,
that's
in parallel.
That's a very interesting point because I think what you're basically saying is that because Vijayanagara represents this culmination of South India's polities, right? In the medieval period, you see this transition happening first from Sanskrit literature to regional literatures. You see the emergence of Telugu poetry with Nannaya. You see the emergence of Kannada poetry with Amoghavarsha and all his successors. But those polities, the Adikavi, Ranna, and all the other great poets, right? But after the collapse,
by the way, sorry to interrupt, but Pampa directly connected to Hampi, directly connected to Vijayanagara.
Yep. So basically, the point I was trying to draw out is that the invasion of the Delhi Sultanate, right, and the fact that the great Kalyana Chalukya Empire that dominated the Deccan collapsed, and that there's this period almost of anarchy where the geopolitics of Deccan is constantly shifting. You have a number of small polities, and they slowly start to aggregate and get larger and larger and more powerful. And Vijayanagara basically represents the culmination of that. In a lot of ways, it actually very deliberately goes out to portray itself as a successor of the Chalukyas. And that is so remarkable to me. It's a gunpowder-wielding South Indian empire that simultaneously uses the imagery of an empire that was born, nearly 1,000 years ago, that actually it leans into the architecture of traditions that are thousands of years old, and also very deliberately goes out to get that kind of literature, goes out to cultivate that kind of literature, spends so much money on it, and over generations, like kind of accumulates that knowledge in that one city. And the collapse of Vijayanagara, the decentralization of that happens during the Nayaka period, the dispersal, as it were, of this milieu that you're talking about, the dispersal of that literati, basically means the end of that particular moment in literary history. So that's a very interesting point that you brought on. So I want to get a little bit into Krishnadevaraya himself as a personality, as a character. Now, up till the point where Krishnadevaraya had come to the throne, Vijayanagara had some moderate successes against the Deccan Sultanates. But he wasn't really destined for the throne, as it were. He wasn't really from the noblest of families. How was it that he managed to come to the throne in the first place?
Well, Raya's succession story is complicated. Historical sources give us various accounts. And you can read about it. I think I narrate some stories, and even in chapter one, whether or not Veera Narasimha, his brother, was in charge, whether or not his father gave him the, you know, throne directly. But to answer more specifically your question, I think what we need to understand is that Vijayanagara Empire itself has a dynastic succession going on, right? So Sangamas, the original guys, that goes into this other Salawa period, and then we get to Tuluva. So there's like this dual, quick, rapid succession of dynasties changing, all done by kind of like generals, not by, you know, lineage holding Kshatriyas or something. Not that Harihara and Bukka were like that anyway, yeah. But whatever. That the whole point is this whole empire is a bunch of upstart guys to begin with.
Yeah.
But you know, how upstarts become like, you know, formalized as great kings and Kshatriyas descended from, you know, the moon and the sun and all that kind of stuff is a different story. But the point that I just wanted to make is that, you know, the fact that Raya was, you know, not of, you know, noble birth or something is nothing unique, to be honest. It's part and parcel for this period, in fact. It's what makes him awesome is that he's just so great in representing what is possible with that kind of social, you know, landscape.
What is also remarkable to me was the way that he, despite being ostensibly of low birth, really went out of his way to engage with the high culture of the court. There's one moment in the book where you talk about his coronation, and he receives advice from a number of senior ministers, and they talk about the seven elements of the state, the seven various kinds of honors, the seven vices of the king. So can you tell me a little bit about how Krishnadevaraya might have seen his place in the world, if you can? Just put us in his shoes. Or sandals, if that's a more appropriate term.
Well, I mean, the earlier part of the question was about, you know, how did he get this kind of knowledge and information, right? Is it, if I understood.
So how did he get this knowledge? And more importantly, why did he get this knowledge? Was it purely out of a love for the knowledge itself? Or at least my personal suspicion is that Krishnadevaraya is an extremely intelligent man. He understands politics, he understands literature, he understands military strategy, and he understands that a certain kind of royal self-presentation is very important to power in his context. So how did he get this knowledge, and what do you think his motivations were for doing it? What did he really do with the knowledge that he gained?
Well, I mean, okay, you're asking a lot of things. Let me answer in one way and see if, because this will be a unique answer also. It's also my musings of my research and even some research of Srinivas Shistla, a great scholar in Visakhapatnam. You see, what was very common amongst the royal families was that princes would be taken and raised in sub-capitals, like places like Penukonda or Chandragiri, or places like this, because, you know, they don't need to be around all that kind of messiness of court, and they should be raised and brought up with a certain kind of, you know, safety, protection, isolation in another respect, but also a time to, you know, get a good upbringing. I believe that Timurasu, who was with the family from the beginning and knew the family in and out, must have taken Raya to be educated young in his youth, somewhere, and I believe, must have been a Vaishnava, Sri Vaishnava matam. If you read Amuktamalyada, and it's pretty clear that someone like Krishnadevaraya wrote it. I mean, it's not Peddanas, so I don't want to get into that discussion now. But to me, Raya wrote Amuktamalyada, no doubt. Now, if you read that work, you will see a massive amount of scholarly knowledge about intricate, arcane Sri Vaishnava stories and theory. The literary skill, all of the, you know, the kind of things it takes for a man to write something like that means he studied deeply with scholars. So this, I believe, is true. So he, I believe, was initiated into a very, very rich understanding of Sri Vaishnava theology, you know, high Sanskrit court culture, all of that, from a very young age. He has another side of his personality that's kind of the playboy running around with Chinna Devi, having a nice time dancing. Yes, fine. He has the image of the warrior. Yes, also he learned and trained in that. But he had a very, very strong education. There is no doubt about it. Not only scholastically, but in terms of the, you know, culture of Accord and what it means. And more importantly, and this is the key to Raya, is ability to interact at all levels of society. You get a very clear sense that this was a man that was comfortable in the court, but was also comfortable on the battlefield, that was also comfortable at a literary engagement, was also comfortable, as he writes in poems, going to the, you know, the kitchen and chatting with cooks, you know, and storytellers and jesters and jokers. So, you know, a very all-rounder, you know. He's a topper and he's an all-rounder.
I sort of flashback of my engineering days when you said that word. But okay, that's a very interesting point. I'd like to draw that out a little bit as well. Because in a lot of ways, the Krishnadevaraya that you describe is also the ideal Indian king as described in a much, much older text, the Arthashastra. The idea that this king must be somebody who is capable of interacting with all levels of society, a highly educated person, deeply schooled in theology, in control of himself, a great literator, but also a great conqueror. Now, what you said about Krishnadevaraya going and hanging out in kitchens, interacting with cooks, interacting with all levels of society, is something that also comes up in a lot of oral legends that are told about the man, especially this idea that he would disguise himself at night, and that he would go out and try to find out his subjects' problems. That's interestingly something that I saw in this Telugu movie called Malleshwari recently. This old Telugu film that was made, I think, in the 1960s. But it's also, more importantly, something that's very often told about Akbar and Birbal. And most recently, a certain Twitter handle, I won't mention its name here, has gone out and said that they just plagiarized from the Krishnadevaraya stories. So two questions for you here. First of all, to what extent do you think these stories in general about Indian kings going out there and talking to them, trying to find out their subjects' problems are true? Second of all, what is the quote-unquote original? Can we ever say that there is an original when it comes to India's oral storytelling traditions?
So, I mean, I can try to answer both at the same time. Fundamentally, you know, stories to me are just another way of understanding history. And history fundamentally is just another way of understanding ourselves. So stories just are about ourselves and how we want to see people, how we believe people are, how we want to be as our own beings in our own time, all of that. So the stories to me are rich. There's no original story. But, and this is just like ragas, you know, there's no one Yaman Kalyan. But there is Yaman Kalyan. And that's the thing, you see. And it's different than Sham Kalyan. You know what I'm saying? Now, what I mean by this is there's no original, but there's original kind of archetypes. There's original motifs. There's core motifs. These have been circulating in India for thousands of years. India is like the, you know, Katha factory. You know what I mean? I mean, you can trace all the Aesop's fables and Panchatantras and Hitopadesh, all of that. You know, you can do that. And people have done all that kind of research. Brad Katha, I mean, no one even read it. It's so huge. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know, unending, Mahabharata, Rama, unending amount of stories. That's part of the great imagination of the Indian mind. Now, our success at storytelling is also a reflection of our sense of what history means. I mean, in the Indian definition, itihasa is Ramayana, Mahabharata. So what I'm trying to say is that the stories are just as much real history to me as anything else. History is basically here in the mind. And if that is what we're getting from these stories, what are we getting? What do I see underneath that? I see great kings who also have a personal touch with an ability to communicate people and be real and yet live at a high level with great thinking. You can be comedic and profound at the same time. You know, that's why all great teachers, great masters, great leaders are always making jokes. And yet they're talking heavy stuff. This is what those stories encode. They show morality, they show humor, they show wit. You know, Vikata Kavi, Denali, Birbal, you know, all same-sames to me. Means they're a mold. Just like the Kaviraja is a mold, you know. Right. And so Bhoja becomes that mold. That Raya becomes that and falls into that mode. It's just rewriting it for the new time and the new context. And for him, at that 1500, it became a really nice new context and a new story, you know.
Hmm. That's a really fascinating way of putting it. Right? There's this ancient archetype that is there, that is well established. And in 1500, Krishnaraya of Vijayanagara molds himself in a lot of ways to that ancient archetype. And he's remarkably successful at it. I think the very fact that he's still remembered as Krishna Devaraya, and that you refer to him as Raya almost like he's an old pal of yours, is very telling. It and it says a lot about the kind of cultural impact that the man.
And it's not just me. I mean, you see, Telugu speakers, you know, nobody calls Krishnadevaraya in Telugu. Raya, when you say the king, there's only one king. Rayalu. And then, you, of course, we give the honorific plural, Rayalu. Rayalilaga chesaru, Rayalid chesaru, you know, ikkariyalaru. You know, all of that, Rayalu. It just means, you know, the great king. He's the man.
The other role that Krishnadevaraya obviously had was that, like you said, that of the conqueror. What made him a successful conqueror? We do hear about his military innovations. What were they? And was that why he succeeded?
Huh. So military innovations, I could speak about a little bit. But what made him a great leader is first and foremost the same thing as before. That ability to connect with people. Raya, like Alexander, like all the other great guys, was on the battlefield with his men, you know, rushing into battle. That inspires. That's what leadership is, man. You have to do the deed. And he was great at that. He was brilliant. Military-wise, though, well, I mean, he was a good strategist, a good tactician. You know, more than that, he had... And I can talk about some of those things, but he had, like, now I'm also thinking, he had just a certain kind of confidence in himself. Like, he had the attitude, like, I'm here to win, and there's no other option for me ahead. That kind of mindset, man, that kind of focused intent was the powerful thing. If this isn't going to work, I'm going to go to this. You know, like, the Raichur is the one battle that I, you know, really detailed. That's probably the most detailed battle of medieval South Asian warfare we have, man. Beautiful scene. And that's where, you know, he can't penetrate this fort, which he's penetrated other forts, but he can't get into this one and he doesn't know what to do. And then he makes friends with these Portuguese guys and uses their superior riflery to, you know, take this fort with quite a bit of ease, actually. So just things like that, you know, again, people connections. It all comes down to making connections, man. Life is all about the people connection. That's what it is. That's what Raya is always showing us, too, in the story. You know, yeah, we have a tendency to think about, oh, the gun saved us. Or, oh, it's the technology that did this. Yeah, that's all fine. But if you don't have a mover, if you don't have a person behind that seeing that, putting that into action, leading that, that's what you need to make it happen. And that's what Raya was all about.
He does seem to be a very self-confident man and also a very charismatic person. I'm guessing a lot of people would just follow him anywhere, right? Without question.
Yeah, and actually now that you bring this up, it gives me an opportunity to say, this same self-confidence, though, basically was his downfall. Or not even his downfall, was the downfall of Vijayanagara, let us say. And I say that in the book. Because, you know, if you look at the end of Raya's life, and I, you know, you can read the book to find out all the details. But certainly, you know, he gets cocky. He gets arrogant. It all starts going to his head. And, you know, now he's conquered all the south. It's all his. Now he wants to also have the Deccan too. You know, the sultans are under his eye. You know, he starts crossing some lines in terms of that noble character that we saw before. He gets a little bit swept away in it all. Nothing happened to him. We don't really know exactly how he's died, but we do know that Vijayanagara soon met a rather sad demise, not soon after. So that same confidence turned to hubris later on.
That's actually, I think, a very poignant note to end this conversation on. And a request once again, if you found this conversation interesting, which I'm pretty sure you did if you've come this far, for more on Krishnadevaraya's career as a literator, on the amazing things that he did with Vijayanagara and the Deccan Sultanates, please join our conversation on May 29. There's going to be a link to RSVP in the description, and also find a link to order Srinivas Reddy's book, Raya, Krishnadevaraya of Vijayanagara, in the description. So check it out. Thank you so much, Srinivas, for joining us. And thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at takshashilainst or our website takshashila.org.in.